we think of life as a journey. It's a mistake because journeys have an end. And once you start getting close to that destination, what do? We move it, right? We move the goal and we never really appreciate that we've achieved it. And that's a shame. And I think if a founder can sit within themselves and be self-aware enough to say, hey, maybe I'm putting too much focus on outcomes and not enough appreciation for the journey that I'm on and showing presence in that moment, maybe they'll be a little bit happier if they're able to do that.
I'm Johnny Page.
I'm Matt Verlet.
And this is the South County Podcast. Welcome to the SaaS Academy Podcast, where we dive deep with SaaS founders and industry experts to uncover what it takes to scale your SaaS to a perfect exit. Today, we're joined by a friend and one of the best B2B sales experts that we know. Not only has he taught SaaS Academy clients to unlock their sales potential, he's advised over 60 companies and amassed more than $100 million in sales for his clients using data-driven strategies to build repeatable processes for their sales teams. Kyle Van Voorhis is the CEO of Voorhis, a sales consultancy for early stage tech startups. And he's here today to share some of his trade secrets. Kyle, welcome to the show.
I can't wait to spill the secrets.
Secrets.
You got secrets. That's right. I've been keeping these for a very long time.
You got a rule. If it's not a secret, you can't say it.
Only okay. Secrets. quiet episode.
yeah, for real. Actually, we'll be hard pressed to find secrets on this topic because you share so much. I mean, you wrote 3 books. 16 Steps to Repeatable Sales is the most recent one. And man, I feel like it is hard to unknow what you've taught. So we're going to have to try to put on the beginner's mindset because I feel like I've just been a big fan of the work you've been doing and recently started working together, bringing you in as the sales coach for SaaS Academy. So super excited to
Yeah, me too. This is going to be a lot of fun, guys.
Yeah. Kyle, I have been able to see you in the middle of your work and see what you're doing now, but I trust you got some reps in early in, you know, you learned the 16 steps of repeatable sales in the lab somewhere. How did you get your start in this? And like, take us through the path of how you built Voorhis and why this is the work you choose to wake up and do every day.
Totally. So yeah, you can't really, well, you can just lie to people and say you've done something when you haven't, but for the most part, you actually have to be out there and do things. So I started in sales, like frontline as an SDR. So I'll give you a quick little backstory there. I got pretty fortunate. I had dropped out of college to do stand-up comedy. As you guys know, I did stand-up comedy for 5 years and I was working at a gym during the day selling gym memberships. So that was my first sales job and I'm selling gym memberships. My boss leaves to go to a company called Intuit. Right? We've all heard of QuickBooks TurboTax. He went over there and referred me. This was my, you know, big break, so to speak, because I was in this weird spot because my whole family was upset that I dropped out of college, all of this. So I started as an SDR. I did really well. I was able to get promoted to an account executive where I was a direct salesperson, left to go work at another company as a salesperson, and then finally started running teams. So I wrote my first book in, I think, 2016, and I wrote the book. Here's a secret. You want a secret? Actually, you know what? I'm going to give you the real secret.
Let's go.
What happened was we had been wanting to write this book on how to be a good SDR. It ends up being called Cold to Committed, but I don't have a lot of time to do it. I'm in a sales job that I, to be frank, hated. It was not an exciting experience. They were changing stuff all of the time. They didn't have a lot of process. So I left and I drove Uber while writing books. So I would go to the airport parking lot where they have all the Uber drivers. I had a little iPad mini and I would type out Cold to Committed. And then I'd go pick someone up, take them to their house, drive back to the airport. And look, it wasn't like enough to survive, but it was enough to like reduce my burn so I could keep going.
Yeah.
So I wrote the book after, you know, 2 months of that or however long it was. And it ended up doing pretty well. I leveraged that to get a leadership role running a sales development team. It was my first time in leadership. And I'll give you the quick version from here. We go through, we build that team from 3 reps to 14, had a couple funding rounds along the way. It was like a real exciting time. Went to go repeat that at a global supply chain software company running inside sales. Did that for a while. And then I started Voorhis. And then from there, from word of mouth, and then we'd have good SEO because I've been writing blogs forever. I was able to build a company where we get to come in and build out that sales infrastructure and help them build like a real strong, repeatable sales process and a well-run team. And then they bring in a VP of sales to scale.
Awesome background. And it's cool. Your success and what you share, I think, comes from the fact that you are in the lab, building founders out of this founder-led sales into a place where they've got some real sales leadership and installing those. You speak like someone who is experienced in doing it. So, man, love the background. I'm curious, you're familiar with this SaaS Academy profile and the jumping off place, and we can use this as a start and go wherever you'd like. But a lot of SaaS Academy founders that come into the program started about 10K in monthly recurring revenue. They're doing founder-led sales and they're kind of struggling through it. I think if there are some, and they, you know, for the most part, get up to about 3 million, 5 million, now they've installed some sales leadership. I'm curious, what are the choke points you see happening? Like, what are the ceilings that they get through in that process? If you solve the problem, you know, at one stage, another one presents itself. I'm curious, like, what are the patterns you see happen through the growth of a early stage company?
So there's a couple of things. The first one is getting your first customers, you know, so having a lead generation process or even channel, whether you're doing cold outreach. I think every founder jumps to cold email super fast, right? How effective that is, you know, big question mark. But anyway, so they're trying to get the first couple of customers, and they do, and they're like, all right, at least we have a little channel working here. Why don't we hire a sales rep so I can get out of sales and I can start getting some of my time back? The problem is when you hire a sales rep, that's when you're getting into sales, not when you're getting out of it. And what happens is you run into this weird problem where the founder feels like they've hired the sales rep to get out. The sales rep feels like they need more support to be successful. So both of them are like pretty disappointed about the situation. But in reality, what would have solved the whole thing is if they had collaborated from the beginning, worked very closely on actually systematizing what was working for the founder and building in some new channels or a different channel that the sales rep could follow through with. So that's the big one. And that hump is really challenging. From there, then there's a big question mark on how systematized have we made everything? Because what a lot of folks do is they have the one rep, now they're working, now I'm out of sales. I argue you're never really out of sales. Eventually you'll hire sales leadership and you'll be out, but you start to step away, you bring on the second sales reps because we can all do math, right? We understand a spreadsheet. We're like, we need more of these little guys, right? So you bring on another one and then you're like, okay, cool. And then that person's not successful, but the first rep was. So then you churn through second reps a bunch. If you can hire in twos, it's always recommended, but you're churning through reps, not really able to repeat the success of the first one. Well, that's the person you poured your heart and soul into if you did it right. We need to continue that process. And then eventually you'll have something that is repeatable, still needs your leadership, and you can bring on a sales leader to replace you. That's how I think about it.
I want to pick up one thing you said and then talk about it for a minute because it was prolific and it's also super counterintuitive, right? And what I heard you say is you hire this sales rep and you're like, oh, finally I've arrived. I have an account executive. I can get out of sales. And really the distillation of this is that by adding resources to your sales problem, you're actually under-resourcing it more, right? You add one person, but take so much focus away because you think you've solved the problem that you actually end up going two or three steps backwards, man. That's like, it's this wild thing where I don't think people realize that until you have it laid out in front of you. And I think that can apply to almost any area in business, right? Where, yeah, I love it, man.
Well, and sales is a very unique part of the business because it's more than just, here's the job that needs to be done. Like we all know you can hire somebody and some people are better at doing a job than other people. But there's a lot of jobs where the better person is going to be more productive, but I can still get the work done with somebody who's less effective. Sales, you can have somebody who's incredibly effective, who is great at their last role, come to your company and absolutely fail. What happened? What was the variable? Did they get sad all of a sudden and stop working? No, right? There are things in place at the other company that enabled them to be successful. So oftentimes there's so much emphasis on the salesperson and, oh, I need a better rep. And they don't know what's really going on. Are the leads bad? Are we hiring the wrong people? Are we just doing the wrong thing? Are we targeting the wrong market? Is our product not good? Am I not good? We have all of these questions that we can't answer because we've ignored a critical piece, in my opinion, which is the operations side of selling. It's understanding what works, what doesn't work, and then why what works works, and then why what doesn't work doesn't. Because let's go down this thread real quick. If something's not working and you don't know why, it's not the end of the world, right? We can all just stop doing it. You know, it's like, okay, just don't do that again. I don't know why it didn't work, but I'm not going to do it again. But if something worked and you don't know why, that's chaos because you can't repeat it. You essentially got lucky. And that's what I try to avoid. And I really try to preach to founders. You have to understand your sales organization at such a deep level. So then that way, you know what you need to do to repeat any success that you have. And that's, I don't know, that's the data is really the secret to that. But as you get used to it and you start running the team, you build that culture and you're very data driven, you'll start seeing that repeatable motion.
How do you understand? I mean, is it cool we go down this rabbit hole for a minute? Like, how do you start to understand? I mean, it's like a joke, right? Two scorecard nerds walk into a bar, you know, that's pretty much where we're at right now.
That's what happened just now, yeah.
Right? But, you know, if you're coaching me as a new founder, I'm like, hey, I accidentally sold a bunch of stuff and I have no idea how I did it. Like, what's the minimum effective dose of getting the lights turned on for someone?
So the first thing is you need to figure out how you generate appointments. So that founder needs to at least figure that out, but they probably know that. They're like, okay, it's all my network. All right, well, yeah. We need to back something else.
Yeah, what else you got?
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Unless you're going to hand off people from your network to, you know, a sales rep, which you might, you know, some people that'll work okay. So you have to figure out what the first channel is that's going to reliably generate appointments for you. So what a lot of wisdom says is you build a sequence, calls, emails, LinkedIn, and you start going through the sequence. It's horrible advice. The sequence is there to optimize your outreach, not to start your outreach. We have to get one channel working, right? We have none right now. So you're going to do all three of them at once? Where else would you ever do that? Never, you know? So anyway, that's where I start, is the appointment side.
Yeah, cool. That makes sense. And there's something else there, again, that I think just applies operationally to any business, which is, and I've done this really, really badly, which is why it's front of mind for me, is, you know, you can go and everyone wants to do automation. Everyone wants to build the thing and use the widgets and use the tech. And you find that we're automating processes that we don't even know if they actually work yet. And you spend all this time automating in the wrong direction. You're like, I'm going to automatically drive into that wall as hard as I can and even know that you're driving into a wall because you haven't done it manually enough times to figure out if it even deserves to be automated, like if it's earned the right. And so I think, like your point, man, it really lands where it's like you just have to play with it a little bit and figure it out before it's sequences and, you know, widgets and all this stuff, man.
I love that, man. Yeah. You got to earn the right to automate.
Earn the right to automate.
Yeah, that's your book. Earn the right to automate.
I'm curious. You said something that I think I've done this every time we've been trying to generate more outreach, which is you build a sequence where it's a multi-touch point. So it's like recall, email, social media, you know, and there's several channels there. You're saying that you would prescribe to not do that, to start with like, okay, so just start in email or on phone.
Yeah, primarily phone. I think the phone is the most powerful tool that we have because it's faster than having to go meet people in person. Not as powerful, but you get to have a back and forth conversation with your buyer. That's incredibly powerful information to get. Yeah. So I always start with the phone. Oh, also it's guaranteed to work. Always works. You talk to somebody who has a problem that you solve and we can't book a meeting. Come on.
Yeah.
That's a you problem.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. It always works.
So smash some beliefs on that. Cause like
we're
there's
the same place. There's,
I feel like I can already hear them. You
Nobody
know,
nobody answers the phone anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the ones I'm sure you handle these all the time in the process of doing what you do at Voris and in SaaS Academy? Like, what's the rebuttal to picking phone first?
Right. So the biggest challenge is the connect rates, right? If I make 100 calls, I might speak to 5 people on just a blank list. And that's the argument people always make is the connect rates are terrible. And they're like, well, my rep will call all day and they won't talk to anybody. And then you look and they made 20 calls that day. It's like, okay, pal, you know, so I'll walk through how I think through it. So here's the first piece. We have to make a volume of calls that's reasonable to expect a human being to make. I always start with 100 calls a day if their main job is making cold calls. Now, what happens? We make 100 cold calls. I just said, on average, you're probably going to talk to 5 people. 3 to 5%, if you grab just a random cold list, is generally what it works out to be. 5% is probably the most common. Well, that's tough because now we're talking to 5 people. But can we get one meeting out of 5? Mostly, probably, but not everybody can. Sometimes you need to talk to 10 people. Well, now you're booking a meeting every 2 days. That's still not bad. Versus sending email, you have similar challenges. You have to deal with deliverability. How many founders have you guys met who are sending like, they're like, oh, I'm sending 300 emails a day. Like how? Like through Gmail. What's your open rate? They're 10%. Yeah, dude, because all of them are going to spam, right? So there's challenges on all of these.
Yeah.
But here's the difference. As I call through a list of leads, I'm organizing them based on if they answered the phone, if they didn't answer the phone, if it's a bad phone number, if I booked a meeting. And now that I have them categorized, guess what? I can start calling the list of people who've answered the phone before in the past, mm-hmm. and I can follow up with them. If you call a list of people who have answered the phone, guess what? All of a sudden, your data connect rate is in the 20s and 30s%.
Yeah.
But that's an operations thing. What everybody does, they make a list, they call through the whole list, and they're like, all right, I guess let's call it again. They go all the way to the top and call it like a brand new list again.
Or then they say your SDR is not good and they fire them.
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, that's the key, is there's a little bit of an operations component here, but it's not like other channels are like magical, right? And how many people do you know doing who's been doing short content, short form video content forever and get nothing from it? Their audience basically never grows. I might be in that category.
Me too. Yeah. So I feel seen, Kyle.
It's all difficult. I know. I didn't have. I was just like, wait a minute. Am I projecting? Yeah. So anyway, that's how I think about it.
Kyle, how much of sales success? You're just such an operations driven guy. I'm curious if there are parts of it that the operator, it's hard for it to solve. Is there like an art or a part of this where you say, hey, even in whatever, I guess, which parts does operation not solve for? Have you encountered them?
Yeah, maybe.
You're just such a data driven and operate. I mean, I've even seen you deconstruct all the way down to how the call goes. I mean, you've taken operator's mindset too. So I think it's where the repeatable success comes from. Probably why you wrote the book. I'm just curious if there's parts of you say, hey, even if we check all these boxes, that there's some gaps that are just left for whether that's dependability on the product, on the person's delivery. Have you found some of the parts that are a little more art or I don't know if we want to call it.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I want to be thoughtful here too. There's a couple of areas that I think it's less operational. There's, of course, the tactics being used on the call. You have to go through a good demo. Your demo needs to really show that you're solving the problems that person's experiencing, not all problems that you possibly can solve. The other one, which is the secret killer to sales teams, is product market fit. So many founders try to outgrow poor product market fit. And when you're early, you don't even realize how bad your churn is, right? So at first you think, oh, this is going great. You'll hit a plateau. And I've seen companies hit plateaus pretty early. I've seen companies at 10 million in ARR who sort of started neglecting the product a bit, got outpaced by competitors. And then now they're in a really bad situation. So product is probably one, and I think there's an operational solution to that, mm-hmm. Just not my area. But that's one that really impacts sales that not a lot of folks talk about.
What are the symptoms you're seeing when that's popping up in an organization? Is it first, is there an operational approach to help surface? Hey, how I might be having, I'm checking all the boxes. I've got a great process in place, but I might be seeing some of the symptoms of maybe I don't have product market fit or the product is holding us back in this area.
So I look at when I'm trying to pick if we're going to work with a client, I look at a lot of product stuff. So this is what I use. I don't know if this is best practice or anything because I've never run a product team, but utilization numbers, if they have them, what percent of your customers are actually using the tool on a daily basis, weekly basis, depending on the product. So that's a big one. Churn is obviously, net revenue retention is another one. These are very obvious examples. Net revenue retention is probably the strongest because you can start seeing how their average customer grows year over year. I think it was ClickUp that famously has 120%, or they did before the beginning of last year, having a net revenue retention that high. And for those who don't know what that is, it's when at the end of the year, your customer base is actually growing. So you're retaining revenue. So if it's 100%, you didn't lose any customers. But if it's 120%, that means your customers grew.
Yeah.
They grew over the year. Now, if every customer grows 120%, you'll pay anything to acquire a customer.
Yeah.
So that's another big one. And then you actually talked about this the other day, the activation stuff, or one of you guys did, the activation, when they're product activated, that's another one that we'll look at sometimes. But those are what I usually ask a lot of questions around those.
Well, let's deconstruct. If you could put a label on, hey, these are the mindset, the things to expect, the label on the bottle of if you're going to be a founder, it's going to successfully make this evolution throughout your business to go from being founder-led to building that initial team. What are the beliefs? or the habits that I've got to adopt to like appropriately understand. Like I say oftentimes, like, hey, the founders, you've got to count the cost. If you knew what you were getting yourself into, you would be less surprised when it was going the way it is going to go. But oftentimes we just think it's one way. It's not that we're averse to hard work. We're going to wake up every day and climb a mountain either way. If we thought this mountain was as big as it is, we wouldn't be surprised. But we thought it'd be, you know, hiring a sales rep.
Hire one rep, I'm good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what is it? How can we set a better expectation going into this game of building the go-to-market strategy and a sales team for a SaaS company so that you have better expectations going into it?
So the big one is you have to have the mindset of a scientist running experiments. That's what you're doing. You're going to run a bunch of experiments. You're going to keep it as controlled as you possibly can to try to figure out what works. And then you're going to repeat those things that work. But oftentimes, like this is why I'm also, I don't really like outsourcing very much, like outsourcing a sales development team, because I want you to own the department. It's your thing. It's so lazy to go, you guys didn't get the result. And you could do that very easily if you hire a third, you know, third party to come in and do the cold calling for you. It's like, oh, I paid them. Then where you get to complain to your founder friends about some money that you wasted and how that firm didn't go well. But it's your company. And to just outsource what is arguably the most important part, sales, I just think it's a mistake. So you have to have that scientist mindset.
I ask this from a place of vulnerability because I had this mindset when I was running my first company in certain ways. Why do you think founders, like, they won't as frequently abdicate responsibility over the product, but they'll abdicate responsibility over the sales, right? And I see a lot of founders where they'll do exactly what you just said. You know, there's always some reason that couldn't be them that sales didn't work, right? Or like, I want to get out of sales, but very few of them like, I want to get out of building this product. Like, why? I feel like it's two sides of the same coin and they're deeply, deeply related. Why do you think that a lot of founders may cling to the product or, you know, welcome the responsibility and ownership over the product, but be in a hurry to, you know, give the responsibility of the sales to somebody else?
Because they can't reject them.
Because they can't reject it. Building is psychologically safe, right?
Yeah, you're building the product. The product can't reject you. You created it. But guess what can reject you? Potential customers.
Dang.
And it breaks your heart, man. I mean, think about this. Think about every day, and you guys have both been in these shoes, so this might resonate. Every day you wake up and you're scared that you're not going to be able to pay your own bills. That this company is not going to get to a place of profitability where you can pay your own bills. You're eating through your savings and that's how you're funding it. Or you raised money and it's a ticking boom, day, boom, another day. And your heart rate's increasing. And you're scared. And then you get to a place where you're sitting down, you're working on the product and you're visualizing the impact that it has. You feel good because you've made progress. And I can see the progress. I can feel the progress. And then imagine somebody looks you in the eye and says, I don't think this is the product we need right now. What's more heartbreaking than that? Wouldn't you run from sales too? Wouldn't you try to hire an outsourced firm that might have figured it out? Of course you would. And then when it doesn't work, what happens? Oh, they sucked. Yeah. They didn't do well.
Yeah. Oh man, that is very sad. I feel like I need a tissue right now because I felt that before.
Can we get a tissue?
Yeah, I want
that. Like, so good. So that is super common, I feel like. And, you know, even having been through that myself, it still gets me in the feels here. And you walk through it, like, mostly because you're such a great speaker. You walk through it, but pulling the heartstrings. But like, how do you lead people as a coach, as a thought leader, you know, for B2B sales? How do you get founders over that hump? How do you reframe the rejection? How do you get them into a place where they can deal with that?
Yeah, and I might get a little heady here, so definitely walk me back.
I'm trying to invite you into that space.
Yeah.
If you're an entrepreneur, you've gone through. So anybody listening who's an entrepreneur understands this, but we set destinations for ourselves. And this is something that I heard, I'll paraphrase it, had a really big impact on me. We set destinations for ourselves. We set goals for ourselves. We try to, you know, climb up hills. We try to make things happen. And it all comes from a place of things that we want to accomplish. But a lot of times, because our self-worth is tied to those things. And the reframe for me that was really helpful is there is no destination. Like, we think of life as a journey. It's a mistake because journeys have an end. And as you guys know, once you start getting close to that destination, what do? We move it, right? Because we know we're going to get there anyway. It's obvious that we're about to hit the goal. So we move the goal and we never really appreciate that we've achieved it. And that's a shame. And I feel like, and this is how I heard it, we'll get to the destination that we've already moved one day, and we're going to say to ourselves, huh, maybe life was like music and we were supposed to dance. And instead we were trying to get to the end. And I think if a founder can sit within themselves and be self-aware enough to say, hey, maybe I'm putting too much focus on outcomes and not enough appreciation for the journey that I'm on and showing presence in that moment,
mm-hmm.
maybe they'll be a little bit happier if they're able to do that.
100%. It's wild because you look back when you've had success, you know, Matt and I have both had successful chapters of the first businesses we were building. And it's funny, man, you look back and you kind of miss at the time felt like a struggle. You missed the climbing. You're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize how special that was. I was so excited to get out of it. Like every month was hard work to get to the others, you know, to get to the new stage. But then you kind of look back and you miss like those early days. So I find myself more and more now being like, oh my goodness, we're in it again. This is what I felt about that, instead of the moment of like, oh man, I can't wait until we X, which is exciting too. Like, but there's a heightened awareness around to be in the fight for something you are excited about. The excitement of wrestling with treating it like a science experiment, the appreciating that there are going to be wins and losses and recognizing that it's a part of the process. Like there's a lot of joy in that process that you miss out on if it's a means to an end. I think that's what you're getting at. Like if we think of it as a journey, you actually miss that when you get there, you're going to kind of wish you were back here. And when you're here, you wish you were there. So,
right.
Man, I think you just put it so well.
And well, there's an obstacle that often we put in front of ourselves. We make things a lot more difficult for ourselves than we have to. And I don't mean like physically difficult, like we added more work to our plate, but like we'll just not enjoy the work but feel like, here's an example. How many of you listening, and then you guys answer here, but have something that you have to do that you really dislike doing, but you do it because you know you need to in order to improve in a certain way? Everybody does. Why do we have to not like doing it? We act like that's something completely out of our control. That there's, how many things have you used to not like and now you like, right? It's completely within our control. I can learn to like something, but we'll almost force ourselves not to like certain tasks because they're busy work or whatever, but we're the type of person who gets it done, right? Yes. Oh, I don't love filling out a spreadsheet manually, but I do it because I work hard and that's what's required to get this company to the next level. Really? Or maybe we listen to music or a comedy show and we're just typing in numbers, laughing, having fun.
Yeah.
You know, so that's
it is really weird. That. And it's almost like a badge of honor, suffering.
Yes. Yeah. Big one.
What is that?
It's a choice too. We choose to suffer. We don't choose what happened to you. You choose like nothing else, right? The things that happen to you, like all that stuff just happens randomly. Even though if you sit with your thoughts long enough, you realize they appear randomly too, right? But we choose to suffer. And it is because it's a badge of honor.
Yeah.
Right?
But only for the founders. And here's the most fascinating part about this is, you know, the founders who are hiring teams, they will say, oh, I can't, you don't earn the right to stay based on your effort. You have to generate your outcomes. And then we assign our own self-worth based on our effort. Because, oh, I can do all this stupid shit. I can do my spreadsheet. I can suffer the most, right? It's supposed to be hard, right? And so it's like we grade ourselves on effort and pain we put ourselves through. But then anyone who works in our companies, we grade them on outcomes.
Right.
If we literally just treat ourselves like we treat our teams, we'd probably be better off on Jump Street.
Probably. Why do you think we do that?
Man, I think that there's probably a part of us that knows that we're deviating from the societal norm. You know, I dropped out of college. For me personally, I dropped out of college to become a fireman. I dropped out of the fire department 10 years later, which nobody does, you know, to start a company. And, you know, there were a lot of people, and statistically they would have been right, where they were like, oh, you know, pretty good chance this doesn't work out and you're going to come crawling back to the firehouse. And maybe I would have, right? But I think that once you reconcile that, okay, I'm going to lean into the weird and I'm going to go do this thing that most people don't do, and it starts to get difficult, I think that it's a coping mechanism for us, especially in the early days when we don't know how to work smart yet. Everyone says like work smart, but that's a skill.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you got to work stupid first.
Right.
And I'm real good at that. Right. Yeah, you're like one. You know? And so like once you get used to not working smart, and because working hard is the only way through, if you don't know how to do that, then there is a correlation between that grunt work and success. I don't think you earn the right to have the successful company if you can't go through that period. So I think there's a point in your journey where that is the right thing to do. And if you don't have the resilience to do it, you will fail. But the problem is there also becomes a point where the thing that helped you is now the thing that's holding you back. We've all heard that before, right? And so it's like not being able to turn the corner of being like, all right, I stayed up till 7 o'clock in the morning writing code for a year and a half straight. But if I did that now, if I started another SaaS company now and I did that, that would be a failure on my part that I put myself in a position where that was required because I know better ways to get it done now.
Was there any fear there of like, if this doesn't work out, then I have to go back to the firehouse?
So I loved the firehouse and I loved being a fireman. So yes, but not because I didn't want to go back to my previous environment, just because I didn't want to fail. And we're all the same. We're all allergic to failure, you know? And so it was more of, I made this bet and I want to see it through and I want to prove to the universe that I can get it done. So there was some fear based around that, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm escaping such a bad situation. Like so many entrepreneurs, they have that story of, you know, I need to escape this job that I hate, you know, the grind, my boss, my cubicle, you know, my soulless existence. Like that wasn't me. Like I was going to work for 33 years. I had a whole, you know, career. Like I was in, I was a lifer in the fire department. I loved it. And like, I accidentally left, you know? And so going back wasn't a scary outcome. I would have had a good life that way too, you know, but I just didn't want to fail.
Yeah. Everyone's worried about that.
Yeah, God totally, forbid, right? Totally.
Yeah. But we say we learn from it.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Right. Oh, we learn from failure. I'm not afraid of failure. Yet all our behavior says we are afraid of failure.
Some lessons are terrifying, you know?
Do you feel like it's a bad thing?
I do. I think we can have the same level of output with peace in between our ears. You know, I think of, there's this space between thoughts that I've been thinking a lot about lately. Have you ever been driving your car and kind of zoned out and ended up at your destination? How the hell did that happen? Who drove that car? I drove that car. I was like looking out the window, but I operated the motor vehicle. And now sit with your thoughts for a second. It's like they appear pretty randomly. So what the hell's going on? What's in that space between thoughts that's so powerful it can operate a motor vehicle while I'm zoning out, and so powerful that it can make me feel like I'm going to be a loser if I don't achieve a stupid result that I've set for myself? It's so powerful, yet is never heard, dictates so much of our behavior. What is that? Is that you? Probably not, right? Because I feel like I'm the one observing it all. So what is that? And why is it so powerful? And how did it get developed? Because I'm not choosing it. And we know, right? Like if you've read any books on psychology, we know your childhood, all of these things, the traumas, they impact your ego and it builds up this thing. But we don't even hear the thing. And we didn't choose the beliefs that it has.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Man, yeah. Have you read, I think you probably have, the book, The Untethered Soul?
No.
Okay, so the TLDR, right, is it's essentially trying to build awareness about your internal monologue. And so like the Matt Verlach version of this question is like, if your internal voice was a person, would you want to hang out with them? And no, for me.
That was a pretty immediate no for me. I was like,
I don't really like that guy.
Maybe sometimes.
But it's exactly what you're talking about. It's like there's this voice in many of our brains. And it's like, haven't even spent a minute to, like, would I tolerate Johnny Page talking to me the way that I talk to myself? No, I would pick him up and chuck him off the balcony, you know, but we take it from ourselves all the time. All of you thought this was going to be about sales.
tricked you.
Said we were spilling some secrets, right? But yeah, man, I don't know. I just, it's a great point. There's so much in there that I think just unconsciously happens because that first step to figuring out, am I going to continue to tolerate the internal voices, making the space to listen to it and like realizing how we're talking to ourselves, you know? And that's a journey I've been on recently. So it's kind of front of mind for me, but like, yeah, it's just like, why do we do this to ourselves, man? Like,
and we all do it.
All do
it. Yet we treat each other like we don't.
Yeah.
You know, we walk around, we pass each other. That guy's an asshole. You know, she doesn't really care. But then in their own heads, they're saying even worse stuff to themselves. And then we're saying worse stuff to ourselves. It's like this crazy thing. And if you were to sit down and have a conversation like this with anybody, you could pull anybody. They have the same stuff. And it's almost a shame that we don't do that more. I get it. I can't do it on the floor of a conference. Maybe I can. But maybe like that's a more important part of all of this than we really talk about. Because I think if you have that level of, you know, peace and awareness that probably be healthier for everyone.
I love talking about this stuff with you, man. You're so open to, you're just open to sharing and observing it. I can, wrestling's probably not the right word. I just see you observing it and discussing it frequently. What have you learned that has helped you create change in this area? You've got this awareness around what's driving some of the behavior, right? What's the tool you're using to create or change the channel from needing chaos or needing, you know, the moving goalposts to create the motivation or create the outcomes to operating with a little more peace?
So there's two things that I do. One is I do like meditation quite a bit. It's very difficult for me because my mind tends to race. It was very difficult for me for a long time, but I worked on it for a while and it's been very helpful for me. Another one that I think is powerful is being aware of the thoughts and emotions that come up and exploring where they come from. So when a thought and emotion comes up that you don't want to have, what do we normally do? We push it down, right? We try to distract ourselves from, I shouldn't be thinking like that, right? Instead, you grab it, you put it front and center, and you look at it. It's uncomfortable a bit, right? I think Jung would say you're confronting your shadow, right? And you look at it and you say, where did you come from? When was the first time I felt this way? And you can't always get to the end of the thread, but you'll get a little bit and then it'll disappear. And here's the important part. Don't feel bad you didn't get to the end. Just go, oh, all right, it's gone now. It's totally okay. On to the next. And it's going to come up again. You're going to do the same thing. And you're going to get through that thread a little bit quicker the next time. You get to the same spot a little faster. You get a little further. Oh, okay. And then you follow the thread. Eventually you'll find the end, or you won't. It'll just disappear because it doesn't want to be found.
So fascinating, the correlation of the types of people who have these conversations and founders and entrepreneurs, right? And I think it's just because like, and it comes full circle. We're talking about being scared of rejection from trying to sell your product, right? It's like, and Dan says this all the time, like, you know, entrepreneurship's the ultimate personal development program, right? And I think in a lot of ways, it's you get those fears thrown back in your face, whether it's product or sales or hiring or whatever. And the only way through is to do exactly what you just said, right? Is explore why and then figure out how to make it make sense.
Yeah, it's easier not to though, because it feels so unproductive in the moment because you're just sitting at your desk like, okay, what's going on here? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Email to get to.
It's interesting how frequently, you know, I don't know, maybe this is just the rooms that we find ourselves in or just naturally what we're interested in discussing, but how frequently it seems there's a initial interest to talk about the tactics, the things in the business that drive it forward. But it seems pretty inconsequential when you're talking about the mindset you have that approach. Like so often our conversation just gravitate towards, and I say it all the time, I can't get through a single day without saying we solve the root, not the fruit, but this feels like the root. It is like, if we could solve that, if you bring a different decision-making and a perspective, a lens to the problems that you solve. Like a lot of what we just talked about is, okay, how can we have the right perspective about building a sales team? How can we have the right perspective about building a company and about a role in the company? It's like, if you figured out a way to change your perspective on things, if you got those tools, you really have the keys to go drive anywhere you want to go. You can create any outcome you want because any mindset that is blocking you from your goals, you now have the tools to change. And I don't know, I feel like it's not a bait and switch. We do care about the tactics in the business, and yeah, there are things you can do to tactically improve. But I think it's why, I don't know, it's at least my current perspective on why does it keep gravitating back to the mindset? It's just such a powerful component of what we're doing.
I think it's the only thing that you just have to let everything go to achieve. Everything else, you have to do the activity, right? I'm a huge fan of Jocko's book, Discipline Equals Freedom, right? And Extreme Ownership is my favorite leadership book. And he's Discipline Equals Freedom, which I think is a very good heuristic for being successful. But I don't know if it's actually true. I think freedom might just be freedom. Discipline is a tool that we use to try and get there. And I think it gets you to a lot of that place, but we still have all that going on in our head. So maybe it's really letting go and not requiring discipline to feel free, and instead being able to feel free with, without anything else.
But how does this show up? Right? Can you give me a before and after for you? Because like I hear that, and if you say, hey, maybe freedom is free, it's easier for me to think about how discipline equals freedom, right? And I can apply that lens, see times when I've done that and times when I haven't. It's hard for me to think about being someone that has ambition and dreams around impacting people around the way I want to show up as a dad. And yeah, you know, it's hard for me to have those and then also be free completely from if I didn't improve in any of those areas. Like, how's it showing up tactically for you? Can you give an example of
I'll give you where before that shift happened? And this will be a little bit emotional for me. I've struggled with my weight for a really long time. And I remember when I worked at the gym, I was in the best shape that I ever been. Cause I'm around a bunch of gym guys, you know, we used to go out all the time. I'm in really good shape. And when I got a sales job, that's where I started to balloon up a bit. And, you know, since then it's been up, down, up, down, up, down. Even talking about it in the third person, like that's interesting, you know? And I remember distinctly, and it's pretty heartbreaking, all of my gym friends, even though I still lived in the area, I stopped seeing because I was gaining weight. And I was like, I didn't want to be perceived as somebody who let myself go. And I didn't do this consciously. But what I ended up doing is cutting off all of those people from my life. People who were a very positive influence in my life. And what did that reinforce? What did that reinforce is that people are going to judge you based on that. So what do you do to try to not get judged? You try to be really fucking competent. So that's what I focused on. And I did stand up for a long time. And what did I figure out really, really quickly? If you're funny, people want to be around you more. And I was funny. So great. Now I can be funny and competent. So what does that mean? People want to be around you and they know that you're going to do a great job at whatever you work on. You're unstoppable. But inside, I still had the, are you looking at me? Are you judging me that way? Oh, I need to look this certain way. Oh, let me push this back a week because I'm kind of starting a diet and maybe I'll lose a little bit. So I'll look kind of similar to how I looked last time they saw me, right? These are the things in the head. Now we all have this stuff. I just wear it on my body, you know? And that for a really long time plagued me way more than I gave it credit for. And the reality is I can work on improving my body, improving my health, without the pain of being worried about what people are thinking about me. Mm. Hey, should I listen to him? He can't even control what he puts in his mouth. There's people who are going to comment that on any clip from this. Yeah, that's probably true. But you put things somewhere too, right? You just happen to be able to see mine. So for a long time, that really beat me up. It doesn't anymore. I don't feel that way. And if I have a day where I eat unhealthy, I don't feel like I've just ruined everything. But that's an internal battle that I've not talked about, but that's been an internal battle for me for a really long time that I've since been able to push through, but I never gave it as much credit as it, I mean, deserved is a weird word, but it had a way bigger impact. And it goes back to your question of, is it good or bad? It had a way bigger impact on my career than I gave it credit for. I don't know if I would have been as successful in my career if I didn't have that voice. Maybe it would have been replaced by something else. You know, like we all have that in some capacity. So in that case, was it good or was it bad? And that's a big reason why I answered, I don't think it's good. I think it's better not to have that because the metrics are a little bit off. Where I'm at in my career, how much money I make, none of that actually matters. We just chose to let it matter. The reality is I can choose to be happy whether I'm barely making ends meet or which I have been in those positions or if I'm doing pretty well for myself. I mean, when I started Voris, I didn't pay myself for 10 months. I was living on savings. My wife was not making an income and we had two kids.
Dang.
Like that's super scary.
Burn the boats, man.
Yeah, you burn the boats. I was scared during that point in my life. For two reasons. One, because I wanted to make sure that I could provide for my family. But the second reason why I was scared was because I didn't want to fail at going off on my own because I was worried about what other people would think. You know, when people ask you when you start your first company, they're like, how are things going? There's a little bit of an intent behind the question. Then they say, are you paying yourself yet?
How's your little company going?
How's your little company going?
It's my least favorite.
Yeah. And it stings a little bit, but guess what? They stop fucking asking at some point.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh. And that feels good. But man, I wish I didn't have to suffer so much during that 10 month.
Yeah, dude, I really appreciate you sharing that. You and I've had some fun chats offline. Like I just enjoyed your openness and I have a ton of curiosity around. I don't mean to turn you into a therapist here, but I feel like I learned a lot from you and I admire you are so incredibly competent. You know your stuff really well. You're also such a friendly, empathetic, and you care about the people that you work with. So I think that comes through, makes the work so much better, and that it's not just where we're going, it's how we're getting there, and got to care for the people that you're doing it with. Man, I feel like we could hang out and chat for days. Is there anything top of mind for you? You've been coaching more in SaaS Academy and having some more interactions with the community. Is there anything that you felt like top of mind that was new, surprised you? Anything you feel like relevant sharing here?
Just the impact of being in person, that always surprised me whenever I do it, you know, because like you get all excited about it, then it fades a little bit and you look forward to it. And then it's always so much better than even, you know, your expectation. And I think if someone's not doing that enough, because since we're all remote now, it's very difficult. If you're not doing that enough, I think it's very worthwhile doing. So maybe a lame answer, but it's just so impactful. And it's very top of mind right now.
Yeah. What we're doing. It's a potent thing. It's interesting. I had someone tell me about an in-person experience. They were like, you know, I came for the tactics and I thought, and it ended up being a lot more personal development than I thought it was going to be. And I was having a hard time figuring out like, what would it have been? Because none of the event was designed for that. But it was my guess right now is it's a curated room. You're in a room full of people who have shared values, and that affirmation of the ability to like see the thing that you value in other people and be like, oh, it's a heightened awareness around that being in you. In an area that you want to lean more into, that's the only thing I can put my finger on.
Yeah.
But there's something about that
proximity to people who are personally developing. Like it's unavoidable. Like there's no way the three of us could sit in a room together for 8 hours and leave the same way we walked in because of who we are. And we,
yeah, you know,
it's 250 people like that with that same mindset. I had a conversation with a founder yesterday after the event wrapped up, and she runs a very successful company that's been growing a lot over the past 18 months, like from, you know, I think 10 or 15K when they first came into our world to, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars a month now. And, you know, she was at the table and having conversations. And, you know, when you sit at a table, you're trying to figure out like who's doing what, you know, who's got the companies that are really big, who are the newer people, right? And she realized that she's so used to being the small fish from her early days, and that there's always people around who have, you know, two or three times her revenue that she wants to learn from. And she looked around and she's like, oh, she's like, this is an opportunity for me to shine my light and share some knowledge, because she was making materially more revenue than every other person at her table. And that was the first time she'd been in that position. And at first she was like, huh, how is this going to work out for me? And she was able to take that and reframe it and realize that it was just this beautiful opportunity for her to be the personal development vector for, you know, seven other newer entrepreneurs who are earlier in the journey where she was 2 years ago. And so it's just like you get put into these positions where you're developing, but also just by your proximity to people who are on the same path, but, you know, 18 or 24 months behind you, you're developing them. And that doesn't happen without the curated experience of sitting around the table, man. So I think it's just proximity.
Well, how many people would have been irritated by that too?
Yeah.
It's just like, what? I'm the largest company here.
Right.
Like I want to be around other large companies, but to be able to be there and appreciate that you get to fill that role is a very special mindset. Yeah,
totally. And that in turn makes her better.
That's right? 100% yeah. It does. Oh,
it's super helpful. Sometimes you grow and it's very hard to see yourself and see how much you're growing without going into an environment and be asked a question to be like something you thought is completely normal. And it's just like paradigm shifting for someone else. Yeah. So that like the avenue to serve helps so frequently you realize, and then it's just like a flywheel keeps spinning. You're saying, oh, I'm capable of growing the next challenge that I'm confronted with. I have all of this evidence now. Not only in my results, but in the things that I'm able to help other people do that say, I think this will be just like every other thing. I'll grow through this. I'll understand and be one day teaching on this thing that I'm learning now. Kyle, I'm curious. You have such an interesting vantage point in the market and building sales teams. Are there trends and shifts coming up that you feel, whether it's a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, like what are the things you have your pulse on, keeping a finger on the pulse of changes happening?
So big fundamentals guy. And I feel like the fundamentals take so much longer to change than everybody thinks. Like we're seeing AI cold calling now, and I've watched that stuff. And I think it's great and it's cool and interesting. It probably is going to be useful. I just think it's going to take a lot longer for traditional methods to actually phase out than we think they will. So I see like a lot of these trends. I see the impact of AI and how it's able to personalize emails. It's allowing people to send a lot more emails, has its own challenges. But what I've seen always be true is that there's zigs and zags. And if you're zagging while everyone's zigging, it generally works out better. So people will ask me like, oh, should there be a GIF in an email or should it just be text? And it's like, people are sending GIFs, you should probably be sending texts. If everyone's sending texts, you should probably be sending GIFs. So it zigs and it zags. The big trends, obviously, is AI. I think it's going to have a big impact. I think it's going to take a lot longer than people expect. Data quality also is a huge trend. I always tell people spend 5x the amount of time and money on the list that you're giving your team than you expect to. And we're seeing a lot of tools that are able to figure out who your users are just by them being on their website and stuff. And I think that's going to progress in a big way. And it might not be exciting for people to hear, but you know, if you're doing sales, the better the data, the better. So that is exciting to me. So anyway, those are like the big things that I see.
Yeah. Awesome. Any tools that you typically recommend to go solve those? I agree on the AI side. I think I have yet to see, there's very few use cases where I see it actually being utility versus a novelty. So right now it's like, it's kind of like putting on the first couple versions of the VR goggles, fun for 15 minutes, but like, you're not wearing them every day. And now there are some out there, I'll say, like, you know, we're in a world where we see lots of, they're in this like rapid experimentation around it. So there are progress for sure. We're definitely a lot farther along than we were 12 months ago, but it is, there's still a huge learning curve. So, but I'm curious on the data cost. I didn't expect for you to say that. Any tools that you're commonly reaching for?
Yeah. So we had a client use Sixth Sense, which was really interesting because it could figure out who was going to the website. And they had a lot of white papers and it was in the cybersecurity space and they weren't really putting in emails. So they had the belief that just cybersecurity folks don't put their emails in anywhere. So they ungated everything and they're using Sixth Sense to still figure out who it was. So the SDR team could reach out to it. I think that's only going to improve over time.
Interesting.
Yeah. Man, I'll plus one what Johnny said. I think that I'm just reflecting on conversations I've had with founders. I do think you're 100% right that they underestimate the importance of the list because I've had a lot of conversations and we will analyze every detail from the calling, the tech stack. Are you using local phone numbers? How are you opening? How are you pushing the pain? What's the, you know, distance to the demo? All this stuff. And spend, but where'd the list come from? I bought it at a conference 2 years ago.
Ridiculous. Like, ridiculous. I got Zoom info.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah.
No. We've just begun, my friend.
Yeah.
It's the most important thing. And it's an asset. Let me give this too. It is a company asset. SDRs, if you have an SDR, somebody cold calling, they shouldn't be making their own lists. It's a company asset. You need to own that. You need to be protective of it. They could get supplemental leads if they need it, but it needs to be a really, really well-preserved and well-managed part of the business. But a lot of folks buy a list at a conference and then they're done.
So you're saying almost treat it like a product.
Yeah, like, 100%. The whole sales team is a product.
Yeah.
Productize your sales.
You mentioned something earlier around, hey, as my, if we're making 100 calls a day, as my SDRs are passing through the list, it should be getting better and better, more and more segmented and enriched as a byproduct. So not only are we trying to, if I saw the 100 calls, not just that they only resulted in 5 connects in one meeting, but that I knew something more about L100 that we made. And we saw that process. I think that we probably would put more attention to what happens on every interaction, not just the ones that result in meetings. I mean, dude, we are living in this very painful world right now. We have kicked the can so far down the road on RevOps stuff. Like literally every single revenue meeting I have, I'm like, oh my God, we found another thing that for years we weren't paying attention to. So I wish so badly that we were more disciplined in this area 2 years ago. Future Johnny will thank me for the discipline we have on it right now. But it's a super helpful reframe to think through building this asset, and every interaction that we have is helping further segment so that the next pass and the next pass and the next pass are even more potent.
Well, one thing I'll say real quick about revenue operations is when you ignore it because you don't have a problem, and then a problem happens and you have to wait 60 days to get the data in order to solve it. So it sucks when you actually hit a problem because you haven't done anything. So you got to do it beforehand, but it's kind of like insurance, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I was just laughing at the different viewpoints that we have, because if you talk about anyone about personal branding, they're like, oh, I need to have an owned audience. I want to build my email list. Everyone thinks about it. And it's this huge asset in the personal brand space. And then in the business space, it's the 47th thing on the priority list that we think about is the quality and data on the list.
Or they call their email list the one that they bought from like ZoomInfo. These aren't people who opted in for anything. And as you guys know, this is a big part of your business. The opt-ins are that's where it all is. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a cold list and you can get something out of that. But like the opt-ins, like that's really where the value is because they've actually experienced the brand. Yeah.
And that's what gets your connect rates up if you're calling those people.
100%.
It's a different game.
Yeah, it's totally different. Yeah, that's a funny one.
This is actually, I don't know that we've ever talked about when RevOps comes into an organization. How does this fit into the Rubik's Cube we talked about earlier of, you know, a founder kind of working their way through? Yeah.
This is the hardest question to answer because every company is so different. If it's like a venture-backed company, they're hiring a VP of sales, it's probably going to be the VP's first hire or somebody on RevOps. What I tell people is what you want to do is have a basic tracking of the sales metrics. And then once the team is large enough where list management is starting to become a challenge, then you want to start thinking about RevOps. Sometimes that happens at 4 reps. Sometimes it happens at 8 reps. It just depends.
Gotcha. So it's probably earlier than, I mean, it makes a ton of sense. And I've seen the playbook happen several times on the venture-backed companies. Like it's the first place that they go. And I probably should have recognized that as a signal earlier than you just saying that, but it makes a ton of sense. It is hard for it not to become this shared responsibility early on. So then it becomes this Frankenstein. So there's more and more friction to solving it. Just everyone just get in there and like create patchwork. And until the fire is like big enough, then we go solve it. But it is, it's kind of, it's like having the flu. This whole CRM's got the flu. Like every single thing is being impacted by it. You just don't realize, you know, how suboptimally you're operating. And because it's not a single choke point. It's like literally everything being throttled. If you're looking at the data, I'm curious if that lines up. Is that what you're seeing? How would you recognize that the list was the problem?
So a big one are connect rates. Like if the connect rates are dropping, the list is probably the issue. It might be a data hygiene issue, but it could also just be a prioritization thing where the team isn't calling the leads that that have answered before, right? So connect rate is a big one. Like when I was running a sales development team, we had 14 reps. We were using like crazy dialers. I had my team on like agent assisted dialers for 6 hours a day. We were making around 300 cold calls a month. Just wild. It's our entire total addressable market. And then we do great. And then we hit a big plateau. And what was the big metric that dropped? Connect rate. Because you're pulling out the people who connect. And if SDRs aren't prioritizing things well, then it becomes a big issue. And then in the sales side too, like one of the things that is often underdeveloped are the deal stages within somebody's sales pipeline. And that could be a big problem as well, because it makes it very difficult to figure out where the drop-off is actually happening. If you have one sales rep that's moving it from deal stage one to deal stage two, when they agree to schedule the next steps versus they schedule the next steps, now we're looking at two totally different scenarios. And you can't use that data very well to figure out what's actually going on. Are we just not booking the next meeting on the meeting? Or is it, they're actually just not showing up to the next meeting. We're not doing a good job really understanding how interested they are.
Almost like defining the workflow is important.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Having definitions.
Kyle, there's a lot of places that SaaS founders can come and hang out with you. Where's the, you know, of course, my preference would be they come into SaaS Academy
and hang out
with you. But you do weekly or you're sharing live on social media, like to, you know, help understand where can we find you?
Yeah, well, I love doing all the coaching calls. So in SaaS Academy, I do the coaching, the sales coaching call every 2 weeks. That's been an absolute blast. I love talking to founders going deeper. The other one is our weekly live class. We do a live class every week. And it's not like a weird webinar where we just pitch a bunch of stuff at you or give you surface level stuff. Like we give tools and tactics that you can take and use. It's awesome. People love it. And then just follow me on LinkedIn. I'm around.
Yeah. You're a great follow on LinkedIn. Yeah. I love you. You got some very potent stuff. You share the process of what you're building and observing. Dude, thank you for joining today. If you're not already following, you're not familiar with Kyle, this is a great introduction and you should go find him on LinkedIn and go join his live class. There's lots of good stuff there.
Appreciate it.
Dude, great stuff, man. Thank you.
Love you too.